play, and then, you know. Okay.
So it is July 21st, 2017. We're in the financial district, and I'm doing a recording with Sunila Mubai for the New York Trans Oral History Project, which seeks to document the lives of trans folks living in New York, and, you know, their experiences. So I'm excited to do this oral history, and I'm grateful that you are here.
Thank
and
you
made it down here.
Me.
Yeah. So Sunila, can you tell me where you were born and a little bit about that place?
Like my parents, or just I was born in New York, but it's just where I was born, like literally, because I went. I was taken to India, to New Delhi, like just a little while after I was born.
Okay, so your early years were in New Delhi.
Yeah, till the age of 8.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about New Delhi?
Well, I grew up with my grandma and my uncle from my dad's side and his family in a sort of biggish house, and went to Catholic school till I was 8 or so. Then I lived here in the suburbs for 3 years. Then I went back again.
Can you tell me a story from like your elementary school years in New Delhi?
Well, I have a photo. I have a photo of mine, I think from kindergarten or first grade, I'm not sure, where I'm in my school uniform with like, it's like a shirt with like the school tie, and I'm looking very serious, and it seems like I have like coal on my eyes, but I don't remember that at all. I can show it to you actually, it's kind of cute.
Can you explain for the folks who may not know what coal is?
Like black eyeliner. Give me a moment. This is definitely worth seeing.
No problem. Oh my god. That looks like a really old school kind of photo. You're not smiling, you're it's like sepia colored.
Yeah.
Now, was that for the school?
I think it was for the school like yearbook or something like that.
Mm.
Or my like school ID or something.
Can you tell me a little bit about this Catholic school?
Well, so one funny thing is I don't really remember this, but my grandma, everyone entering the school had to do an interview, like an entrance interview, because they love like examining people in India from like age 2 or something. So in the entrance interview, the like headmaster or whatever, it's claimed that he showed me, I was like 3 and a half or 4. And if he showed me a purple toothbrush and said, "What color is this?" And I apparently said mauve. yeah.
Wow. So then you were admitted immediately for your precocity.
Apparently it seems like that. I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not.
Well, it sounds like you had an early aptitude for language.
For mauve,
yeah. So in this Catholic school, was it an English language school?
Yeah, was it English language.
Okay.
And they taught Hindi as a second language. And yeah, it was all the like males in my family since my family came to New Delhi after partition, attended the school, so I was just also like put into it.
So you have a family legacy there.
Yes, a little, at least like 4 people in my like extended family went there.
What, may I ask, what's the name of the school?
St. Columbus.
St. Columbus.
It was founded by Irish Catholic brothers sometime in the 20th century. I don't know.
So it was Catholic, not Jesuit?
I believe it was Catholic, yeah.
Okay. And so where, can you tell me a little bit about where your family was from? You said they came after partition. Can you explain a little bit?
Well, this is just talking about my dad's family, to be clear. My dad's family are Kashmiri Hindus, or Pundits, as you love to point out. I guess it's an ethnicity. But none of my immediate family lived in Kashmir. My grandma and my dad and uncle and his siblings were born in Lahore, which is now in Pakistan. And they came to Delhi in 1947 after the sectarian violence of the partition, when they had to flee Lahore because it was now part of Pakistan. And so being non-Muslims, their lives were in danger. They had to pack their bags and leave, and eventually they ended up in Delhi.
I know they
lived as refugees for a few months or so.
Okay. When they arrived in India.
Yeah, like when after they crossed the border.
Do you know at all what their lives were like when they were living in Lahore? What they did.
I know my great grandfather was like worked for the British government. I think in the postal service or something. And my grandfather was a my dad's father was a railway engineer. Yeah, I think they were from like a upper middle class family, and they spoke Urdu as their like mother tongue, even though they were not Muslims. But pretty much everyone who was educated, regardless of sect, Urdu was like their, and English were their lingua francas.
So then they came to New Delhi eventually, sometime after 1947.
Yeah.
Did you grow up with any stories about what that time was like for them?
Yeah, I mean, my grandmother would talk about how, like, she left her lovely home behind in Lahore and everything was taken away and so on, but without, like, any kind of sense of, like, sectarian resentment against Muslims as a sort of blanket category, whereas apparently her brother was very bitter and like blamed the Muslims for everything. I know they kind of had to start like all over again, although my grandfather retained his job in the railways, and so they were able to like settle down and live in like have like a decent house and so on and so forth. And that's how I think, I'm not sure how exactly my dad and uncle ended up in this Catholic school, but I know it was really different back then. Like, there were hardly any cars in the street. That's what my dad always says. Like, he was able to bike to school comfortably every day. I'm trying to think what else.
Did your family ever have a chance to go back to Lahore or no?
A couple of my grandma's brother went back a few years later, I know, to see what was left of their home and so on. And my grandmother herself didn't get to go back until just a few years ago, like 10 years ago, a few years before she died, when my dad was going for a wedding and he managed to get her a visa for Pakistan. And she visited the house where she was born in the old city of Lahore, and the people living in it apparently still, they knew about it, was her, it was named after her father, and they still called it by his name, so they were like really happy that she had come back and were like really wanted her to stay with them and so on.
Wow, that must have been extremely emotional.
Yeah, she was really old by that time, but she still remembered a lot, and it was like a great, my dad said that it added like 5 years to her life or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
To go back and to,
yeah, to connect. Yeah, to connect with her, like where she was born.
Wow.
It was like in the old city, so it was more like, you know, one of the wall, it was in like similar to like an Arab home, or you know, with like a
where
courtyard.
The family house, and you have different floors.
Yeah,
for each
with a courtyard.
Generation.
But they, she was only born there, but then he, I think my great grandfather moved out of there into like a bungalow type house in the new city. And that's where she mostly grew up, I think.
And besides your father, did she have other children?
Yeah, I have an uncle and an aunt.
Yes.
My dad's
Sorry.
The middle child.
Yes. Okay,
yeah.
Got it. Yes, you mentioned your uncle,
yeah.
Sorry.
They went to like kindergarten, I think, or something before, or first grade up till partition. So they got to learn how to sing God Save the King in Urdu.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a useful
yeah.
skill,
yeah.
I'm sure. So, okay, so they're in New Delhi. So then, and they were able to get a home
mm-hmm.
and attend this Catholic school
yeah.
that you were in, right? So after you were 8 years old,
mm-hmm.
where did you go to school?
I was here for 3 years.
Here being New York.
In Long Island for 3 years. And then I went back. When I went back, my old school wouldn't, like, have me back.
How come?
I don't know. I'm not really sure why, but I think school admissions are, like, super competitive, and if you leave, you know, they don't really want to give you your place back until... So I went to an international school that was run on the British curriculum.
So can you tell me a little bit about what that means, the British curriculum?
It's the same curriculum that they do in the UK, basically.
So like A-levels?
A-levels, O-levels, and A-levels. Yeah.
Okay.
There's an extra year of high school.
Were you learning Hindi there as well?
No, so in this school, Hindi was optional, and like in the Indian curriculum, it's mandatory until 10th grade, until your first like major exams, and then but here it's not optional. Mm. I mean, it's not mandatory, so I took French instead.
I see.
Yeah.
And, can you
But I learned, like, because I was in primary school, I learned, like, at least to read Hindi. But I don't know. I can't really, like, read it very fluently or anything.
And so when you went back to New Delhi, were you living in the same house?
Yeah, in the same house. Literally. The same bed.
Can you tell me a little bit about some things that you liked to do when you were growing up, like for fun or?
It was mostly playing cricket in the park, that was like the main daily activity. Even though I sucked at sports and always, but that was like pretty much the main thing. apparently, I don't know. I don't. I was too. I was too little to like be able to remember. But I would demand to be taken to the rail museum every Sunday when I was like younger.
The rail museum, as in a museum to the railway.
Like a museum of the like railway, you know, of trains. And, you know, of like the Indian, because the railways are a big thing. And
this is where your grandfather had, was it?
Yeah. I didn't, my grandfather died before I was born, but I think my uncle who I grew up with, like, loved trains also. So I think that's why, I don't remember this very well, but I don't doubt it, I guess.
And when you were growing up, can you tell me a little bit what kind of messages you got about gender? Or
I had a very Victorian upbringing, I think, when it came to gender and sexuality. It wasn't very aggressive masculinity, I think, that I was raised with, but it was definitely, there was like some masculinity, and also going to an all boys school at an early age, there was like a certain, it was assumed at home that like all my friends would be boys, although that we had like neighbors that had daughters who I played with also, but yeah, at the same time though, I like, because I was like raised by my grandmother and she was really overprotective, I think I got a lot of like feminine energy, and I think I had a certain kind of that was always like a part of me, and I remember one time in school we had to, there was some kind of pageant for one of the like religious festivals, like the Hindu religious festivals, and I was chosen to like dress up as one of the goddesses or something, I think, and apparently like I looked so good in it, or I did it so well, that it was like I got made fun of, and I remember that was like kind of disturbing for me, or like, you know, sort of like I didn't want to do it, or it was like, why did it, you know, why was it such a good fit or something like that.
Do you remember how you felt playing this goddess, or what that experience was like
for you? I remember feeling super embarrassed during the performance. It wasn't very long or anything, but yeah, there was this kind of like a sort of, you were like the unlucky one who had to play like the female figure or whatever.
Can you tell me a little bit about your grandmother and like describe her for me and who she was?
She was like very strong woman. I think she basically kept our family together after the partition and prevented anything, and kind of like she never like had an official job, but at the same time she was very like active in the community and kind of like one of the more progressive voices, I think, amongst her relatives. I think with me, she was kind of a little different because my mom being mentally ill, and like she felt I was kind of a special responsibility that she had to take care of. I know that she wanted to be a singer. She was apparently had a beautiful voice. And could have been a professional, but it was still not like, it was still frowned upon at like at that time, because public performance was associated with like being a courtesan or whatever. But she continued to sing in like family functions and things like that.
What kinds of things did she sing?
Like Indian classical music, basically.
Like,
and she played the harmonium.
Oh, also, okay. Yeah. Like North Indian.
Yeah, North Indian classical music. Yeah.
I guess we can geek out about that after this oral history, so we don't take up that much time.
I don't know that much about it, but I know something, a little bit.
Yeah, I when I was walking to B&H a few weeks ago, I passed a restaurant called Patiala Restaurant.
Oh, okay.
I was like, oh yeah, Kavali music.
Oh,
you know, the Patiala school. You know.
Yeah, of Kavali.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Patiala
is a town in Punjab.
Right.
Yeah.
No, but that's a different thing.
But that's apparently a stereotype of Muslims in Bollywood, that they just they sing Qawwalis all the time.
Right. Well, that there was a guy I went to school with who actually wrote a paper comparing jazz musicians in in Hollywood film at the turn of the century, to the representation of Muslim musicians in early Bollywood film. And there are very striking number of parallels.
Yeah.
On lots of levels. It was interesting. But yeah, that's, wow. So she would sing at family functions.
And at like at larger functions also.
Did you ever do singing or any kind of music?
I tried a little bit, but I don't think I ever had an aptitude, much of an aptitude for it. I mostly had an aptitude for memorization.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. And how did that manifest itself when you were growing up?
We had in school, we had like, there was like some class where you had to memorize really cheesy poems and like repeat them. I think I was good at that. Or I like learned the rules of chess when I was six or something, but I was never like good at the game itself. Well, like I wasn't a grandmaster by 10 or something.
Right. I hear that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you're in New Delhi.
Yeah.
Did you do high school in New Delhi as well?
Yeah.
Okay. So you went all through the A levels or the O levels or whatever levels. And then you, where did you, what were your thoughts around your next step when you were finishing high school?
Well, it was assumed that I would go to college in the US, but I think I just naturally gravitated to New York, given that I had somewhat of a connection and some family in the area, and also like it just seemed like the most natural thing. So I applied to Columbia and NYU, and I got into Columbia. And I don't think it was probably the best fit for me as a college, but it was definitely good to be in New York.
And was that the... So I just had to change the card because the card was full. So we're just going to back up a little bit.
Sure.
So you lived mostly in New Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
You came to New York. You had a connection here.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking a little bit about how things felt a little like socially strange, I guess, when you were studying in undergrad. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
It changed a lot for sure by the time I finished. And also around the time I was starting was also around the time I came out as trans and then later genderqueer. So it was like a very difficult, it was an intense time for me. I mean, I think it's something I needed to do for sure. But it wasn't, gender wasn't like as, I think it's definitely changed in the last few years where it's become, being trans has become more like a common thing. And it wasn't that common at that time.
Can you tell me what year that was?
Like the early 2000, 2003 or so. I was supposed to start college in 2002, but I just needed like a year to get used to living here. And it was, yeah, it wasn't as, the transition wasn't as smooth as I thought. And Colombia also wasn't like the queerest place. It still isn't, but it wasn't at that time also. Like, they kind of had reached gay, but they hadn't, they hadn't really reached trans at that time. And I guess, like, coming from a very, like, achievement-driven sort of educational background, I kind of was hoping that it would be a little different, but at Columbia, it was still, like, most people were extremely achievement-driven, it was, like, a pressurizing sort of atmosphere, although not to the same extent. And I guess just also like the way that people socialized and related to each other was not kind of the way that I was used to, and I hadn't really had a very easy time socially either. So at some point, like, I realized like I wasn't comfortable living in the dorms, so I decided to like move out and sublet a room instead because I felt more comfortable. Stuff like that, I guess. And I was kind of young and very like eager to prove my like intellectual ability to argue, and so I ended up having a lot of like run-ins with TAs and professors and so on. And I guess I had this like impression that in America, every, you know, the in academic atmosphere was not strict and rigid like it was in India, where you have to like bow down to the teacher's feet all the time and call them sir and ma'am. But I discovered that there's still like a lot of hierarchy and deference, and that, you know, you kind of were expected to know your place, but in a more sort of subtle way where you had to pretend to be equal, but you're not really equal. So that was like a very difficult thing to adjust to me, for me to adjust to.
And when you came out as trans, did you have other trans people or gender nonconforming people you were connecting with at that time? Did you have like some circle of support or any of that?
A little bit. Not. I had a few queer friends. Then in sophomore year, I did manage to get in touch with the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, and they were super helpful and nice, and they helped me like change my name and gender on my documents. And then I did an internship with them for a semester, so that was nice.
How did you hear about them?
I'm trying to think. I think I met someone, maybe I met Dean Spade at a event or something, and he asked me to contact someone to help out with my and they were super super helpful, basically.
That's cool.
And trying to and like I kind of got involved with like anarchist politics, and at that time I think that's how I met them too, but I never kind of felt comfortable completely in the activist community. It, there's kind of always this weird like similarity I noticed between the activist and the academic, where there's kind of this pressure to like push yourself as hard as you can until you burn out, which always like made me uncomfortable. And I'm still like trying to find where I exactly fit in or belong.
Now, you know, you started studying Arabic in undergrad?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was kind of an I don't know if it, looking back, it was an accident, but I was just interested in a bunch of, I wanted to be a creative writing major and a gender studies major, obviously. But I never like, I kind of felt like the women's studies classes were, for one thing, they gave assigned way too much work. Like they had to sort of prove that they're, you know, a serious class or something. And it was kind of like, I guess I wasn't like comfortable with the way that, gender was this very like cold sort of academic thing that, yeah, and just the requirements were like ridiculous to major in it. And similarly with creative writing, I was kind of like, I never really felt comfortable with the sort of workshop format of creative writing, where you kind of share your work with all these people that you don't know what their like belief systems are and so on, and you know, open. And I remember like opening myself up to criticism in a way that was really like difficult for me to take. Like I remember coming out crying several times after a workshop, and like feeling really like crap. And so I happened to like find out that the Middle East and South Asian studies major was like had a lot less requirements, and you know, was like much more open-ended. The only thing was that you had to take a language, and I was just kind of like, well, I don't want to study Hindi, that's would be so stereotypical. So I was like, why not Arabic? And that's kind of how it started.
And so you were studying Arabic pretty much immediately after 9/11.
Almost, yeah. Like, I guess I started in 2004. So just, yeah. I knew the alphabet as a kid because my grandma, like, one, she just wanted to make some attempt to make sure the heritage of Urdu was not, like, lost on her grandchildren. So she, like, taught me the alphabet, but I didn't know, so I had like some idea and not and the like whatever common vocabulary there is, but Yeah, so it was, yeah, 3 years after 9/11, basically. So, or a little less than 3 years after 9/11.
Did you, looking back on that time, what effect or impact did 9/11 like have, if any, on the teaching or learning of Arabic at Columbia for you? Or did it?
I remember that when I started, it was just around when the demand for Arabic had become like, was starting to like really get big, and getting into like a class was a big problem in and of itself, or like a big thing for those who were interested. And what am I? Yeah, I remember talking to people later on who were a bit older, and them saying that like, you know, when they studied Arabic pre 9/11, it was a lot different. It was kind of like studying anything else that's kind of obscure and not like French or Spanish or whatever, and it was kind of like cute and nerdy and whatever, and there wasn't like this you know, sort of huge political weight attached to it. I don't remember there being that many like wannabe spies or anything in my Arabic classes. A lot of like people who sort of, I don't know, want to, I guess, because Columbia had like a policy school and so on, with a lot of like do-gooders who want to like save the hungry children or whatever. So I think there are quite a few of those. And then like the academic types also, who often like don't have any sense of politics. Although like I think it's good to some extent to not try to over politicize the classroom, because then things can get like extremely petty. I remember in my advanced class, our teacher, who was really, really good, like tried, you know, would kind of steer the, every time someone like criticized Zionism, he would try to sort of keep the discussion onto like whatever story we were talking about and not like go into polemic. Just to like not waste the time, which I think was good.
Had you traveled to the Middle East before taking Arabic?
No, I hadn't. No. I think that's good, probably. Palestine was actually the first Middle Eastern country I went to. And unless you count transiting in Dubai.
Well, I don't. No.
And I was actually denied entry into Dubai last year, which was really ironic, and on the basis of my gender, basically.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that experience?
It was really strange and bizarre and kind of like weird. I was just supposed to spend a night there between like transiting planes and in order to go to the hotel, I had to like enter the country officially, and immediately as like the passport person saw me, they were like, and I went into this whole thing where like these, and they never like gave me the chance to like show that I knew Arabic, so I didn't, and I like heard them like, they like body scanned me the way that they do with drug smugglers, and I heard them like discussing my genitalia and then like asking me like, what really are you, and
in English,
yeah, but then discussing my genitalia in Arabic, and like And my dad and stepmom were traveling with me, and I heard them like making fun of them for like not being ashamed of their kid. It was all like, but it was all like, it was just to like spend 10 hours there, basically. I didn't have to get, thankfully, I didn't have to get deported because they're just like, you can't enter, you can go back to transit lounge.
So you stayed in the airport for 10
Yeah,
hours
yeah.
because of your, their
Gen yeah, their
perception.
perception of, because they said I'm a liar. And that, like, even though, like, I showed them my other IDs, which say I'm female, they were like, you can't enter the country like this. And once you are fully a woman, you can enter the country.
They said this to you.
Yeah.
Wow,
Which was like,
that's kind of interesting.
And the funny thing was that on the flight, the short flight from India to Dubai, I was like watching a movie made by a Emirati poet about like the traditional fishing trade in the Emirates, and kind of being like, oh, it's, they're not just all like oil sheikhs, they have culture and history and blah blah blah. And then that happened.
That sounds awful. I'm
Yeah,
really
I mean, it
sorry.
was like,
I'm glad you were with your father and your stepmom at least to just,
well, it wasn't
I
like,
don't
so
know.
it didn't like make much of a difference, really. They didn't like threaten me or hurt me, they're just kind of like treated me like this bizarre alien that, couldn't be trusted or something.
Now, so dialing it back a little bit, when did you go to Palestine and can you tell me a little bit about that trip?
Well, I've been to Palestine 3 times. The first time was for a short visit, and the second time and third time were for like a longer trip. I got very interested while I was studying Arabic in Palestine solidarity, activism, and kind of thought it would be like, because they didn't, in school, they didn't really teach colloquial Arabic, and they only taught like Fusha, which is book, formal or classical Arabic. And I was like, I wanted to like watch movies and speak with people and so on. So I thought maybe that would be like a good way to, yeah, that I thought that would be a good way to like, although I kind of found out later that it, well, it was kind of a good way, but it wasn't like really my scene completely. Actually, most of the people that I interacted with had like, they kind of thought that learning to read and write Arabic was a waste of time because I want to like speak to the street and whatever. So it's kind of this like anti-intellectual attitude.
Did you have trouble getting into Palestine with your gender?
Not with my gender, but I did get interrogated because my name doesn't really sound Muslim exactly, but it doesn't really sound like Western either. And so there was just like a lot of questions of like, are you a Muslim? Are you, why are you sure you're not a Muslim? Like, is anyone in your family Muslim? Like, how my, and in fact my mom's family are Jewish, but it doesn't reflect in my name. And yeah, so in the end I was able to get in, although it's not something I really look forward to, and I would definitely not want to go in through the airport again for sure. I'd rather try one of the land borders.
And So you've traveled quite a bit throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, more in the Levant than, yeah. And I've been to Morocco as well, briefly.
And did you encounter these, you know, because a lot of people haven't had quite that ability to travel as much, mm-hmm. who are gender nonconforming or yeah. trans. Have you, you know, what have been some of your experiences traveling? Besides, I know that Dubai was not,
was terrible. That was like the worst.
Well, it was in an, yeah.
That was pretty much, in other places, like I get asked, I got asked in Egypt and about my gender, but they kind of left it at just questions. And the fact that I had a U.S. passport, like, I guess made them respect me more.
Did you have any issues, like, being, like, going through your day-to-day?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, mostly, I guess I was perceived as, like, an effeminate man, and I had to deal with what that engendered. I often would occur to me, like, it's actually kind of cool that, like, the large majority of people aren't, like, harassing me in the street. It's, there's a lot of people, but look at all these other people that just walk by, and isn't that cool? But I liked it when I caused confusion about my perceived gender. I didn't like it when I was read as, like, an effeminate man or drag queen, because that would bring out more hatred. And I often wonder, like, what is it that propelled me? I just really had, like, a dedication to language that I was willing to put up with a lot of things for. And yeah, I mean, I think I was read mostly as masculine, but not a traditional masculinity.
What can you tell me, a story of one of your favorite teachers that you've had? Because you've been studying Arabic for a long time.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about it?
I haven't been studying in a class for quite a long time now. I think my third year of my senior year at Columbia was when I had two really, really good teachers who really pushed me a lot and, like, helped me sort of take a big leap. One was Tunisian and the other is Lebanese. And both, I think, like, encouraged me to, like, make this a major part of my life. Although probably I would have liked to do something other than a PhD. I don't think it's been bad to do a PhD necessarily.
And so did you ever go to Syria? Were you able to? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, you went to Syria
before,
too? Oh.
I was in Syria in 2008.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that experience?
It was a little bit different in terms of, like, you know, Egypt and Palestine are more globalized, I guess, in terms of, like, internet and phone.
Like the cities.
In terms of, like, infrastructure and so on. Syria, there was a little bit more closed, and some things were a little more difficult, and there was more bureaucracy. Also for U.S. citizens, because there were, like, extra security measures, or I don't know what. So, like, it was easier for, like, Europeans to get residency or whatever, or to come in and out of the country, than it was for Americans. But I was there about 6 or 7 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In which city?
In Damascus.
Studying Arabic?
Yeah, and just, like, private lessons. I took a Persian class there, too, because it was at the Iranian Cultural Center.
And how was that?
It wasn't, the teacher was nice. He praised Ahmadinejad a bit, but he was a sort of nice guy. And the textbook had examples like Muslims of the world defend Palestine or something.
Wow. Can you, you know, now Syria obviously is in a very different place, and it's interesting to hear your perspective because you have such a unique subject position as someone who's studying the language, etc. And
I remember that one unique thing was like interacting with all the Kurdish people
in Damascus.
Yeah, in Damascus, a lot of the poorer Kurdish people worked in restaurants and cafes and stuff, and when they found out I was Indian, that they were really happy because they felt like I was their Aryan brother or something against the Arabs who were oppressing them. But in all conducted through Arabic, of course. And they would like ask me random words in Kurdish and be like, is this the same word in your language?
Wow.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of, I guess there's a bunch of common vocabulary through Persian, because Kurdish has a lot of Persian words.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what like your day-to-day life was during that 7 month period in Damascus? Like, what was, just like, get me a sense of what it was like living in that city in 2008.
I mean, also it was a little closed off in the sense of like a lot of broader swathe of people were not used to interacting with foreigners, and that was kind of one of the attractions of going there, was that you would have to do everything in Arabic. But you know, I would like go to I would have my lessons, I would like do my reading, I would I think I volunteered for a little while at the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, and then stop teaching English conversation. Yeah, and I mean, a lot of time went by just trying to like settle down and find a place to live and that sort of thing. And then by the time it did happen, it was kind of time to go.
So what was your living situation when you were there?
I was living with some other, I was living with another American who I probably shouldn't have lived with. It would have been easier. I know a lot of foreigners wanted, lived in the old city in like houses, traditional houses that whose rooms were rented out, but I never really wanted to, I didn't feel comfortable living in a walled city. And
did you have any sense of like the political climate at that time?
Oh, I mean, it was funny that like you kind of just internalized the repression very easily. Like, you know, I hardly ever found myself talking about like the government, Assad in public. Like, you know, it was just like normal, you know. What else? Although there was, I mean, there was criticism of like the government constantly, or of corruption or nepotism or whatever, but never of the president or of the party.
And of the Baath Party.
Yeah. The party.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. What other party?
Well, I mean, for...
Well, actually, technically...
For the listeners.
For technically, there, it's a... The Baath Party is part of the national, like, coalition or something, but the other parties are there just in name. And... Yeah, so it was... But I did, like, I did study, one of the people I studied with was a Palestinian who had been, who knew like some dissidents and who had contact with other dissidents. And so, you know, we would talk about politics and stuff like in the home. And also some of the lessons I was taking were at the French Institute for the Near East, and some of the teachers there would show like banned films inside to the classes, like inside the institute.
Now, a couple years ago, I got an email from an Arabic professor. She's American. She's not Middle Eastern, but she said, you know, do you have any advice on how to help my student who's gender queer or trans? I don't recall how they identified, but basically this person, after a semester or maybe a year of doing Arabic, said, I can't deal with how gendered this language is, and stopped. And so this professor was reaching out to me and said, is there a way, are there other words, you know, that will maybe be of interest to them about gender and sexuality, or, you know, have, do you know people who have this issue?
Well, if she's the Arabic professor, shouldn't she?
Well, not all of them are up to speed if they're, you know, if they're straight or they're not exposed to
different
things. I mean,
it is a super gendered language. There's no way no way to get around that. But I don't think the issue is in the language so much. I mean, Persian is a completely gender neutral language. Like, you don't know if you're saying he or she, you're talking about he or she when you're talking about someone in the third person. But obviously Iran isn't the greatest place for a transgender person to be. So it doesn't quite, you know, it's not that, I don't know how to say, like, it's not that automatic. Or like Hebrew, for example, is even more gendered than Arabic, because in the, when you speak Hebrew and you're like saying, you know, speaking in the first person as a present tense as a verb, that's gendered, whereas in Arabic that's not gendered. But, you know, whether is it like, you know, in some parts of Israel, yeah, I guess it's like easier to be gender non-conforming, at least. You know, not to be pink washing or anything, but, you know, that's a like basic reality, sure. So I mean, it's not that like, you know, I don't think the relationship is that like linear. I mean, then of course there's like the whole rich like literature on gender and sexuality that there is from medieval Arabic that really like gave me an extra boost towards continuing in the language. Although it didn't end up being my thesis topic, I think I wish it had, but you know, there's all this like so many different, I think like dozens or hundreds of books on sex and gender, and all different in the fields of like literature and like, you know, anecdotes, and even in religion, of you know, of like detailing everything basically, and even like linguistic compendiums of like all the different words for genitalia, starting from the beginning of the Arabic alphabet to the end of the Arabic alphabet, and it's like hundreds and hundreds of words.
Oh man, I can only cover like 3 or 4 letters. I don't know all 26 letters. I have to read that.
I mean, the letters of the Arabic alphabet.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking like kaf.
Yeah.
You know.
And these were all like, I mean, I think the issue, they're mostly, most of what is we have was written by men. And like men, but they were like, the paradox is like, they were like men of religion, and many of them were deeply like pious, But yet they still had this attitude to knowledge that was, whereas like everything had to be talked about and dealt with. And there's even like a great quote by one of them, Al-Jahiz, where he's like, people who complain about words like dick and pussy and whatever, that they're, that they're like immoral or that they're like offensive, should shut up, because if these they wouldn't have been they words these words wouldn't exist if they weren't meant to be used. But I think like social attitudes can change a lot. I also think like the intense gendering of the language like makes it possible to play more with gender, like the word for vagina or for pussy that's used in current colloquial Arabic is masculine gendered.
Same thing in French, vagina is masculine.
Le vagin.
So is queen was in medieval French,
Oh,
queen
really?
was masculine.
See, you know something about language that I
I know
don't.
those two facts.
Yeah. What was it in medieval French?
It was still the same noun, but it was just masculine.
Oh,
Löwen.
Ren, Le
Yeah,
Ren, Le.
Löwen.
Interesting. I know that in German the word for girl is neutral, is neuter gendered, das Mädchen.
Well, are we surprised?
Yeah. Or for child also, das Kind.
So, let's just, I just have to pause for one
Sure.
sec. So I guess my final question as we wrap up is,
I guess I just want to say to the student that like don't despair, like there's a lot of gold pots at the end of the dark tunnel that
yeah.
are awaiting if you like if you persevere right now.
That's, I wish I had said that. I responded and I just said, well, they should keep studying it, but I didn't have an eloquent, informed response, sadly. But I guess my last question is, you've lived in a lot of different places, you've studied, different languages, etc. How do you feel, has your study of other languages and, living in different places, etc., how has that impacted your understanding of your own gender? I guess I know that's a big question, but that's just, or has it, or
I think that's a good question.
it's
I
pretty
mean, it's
big.
definitely shown me that gender is a performance, and also helped me see that like sometimes passing or like how my gender is perceived has may have, I may have no intention of, being perceived as more feminine one day, and yet I would be, which was interesting to me. And so I guess it just shows how much it's about perception to a large extent for me. Or it's shown me that where like some random aspect of my appearance or my gait, like will like completely alter the perception, or the same perception would be perceived differently. The same like appearance or whatever would be perceived in differently depending on where. I guess the one thing I didn't dare to do in the Middle East was use the women's bathrooms. I was too scared. Except, well, maybe in Palestine once I did, but it was like a single. And even then, like all the people at the restaurant were like, "Why'd you go to the women's bathroom? That's like, un it's they said it's r ishi saab ktir, like it's really,
Yeah, it's really tough.
yeah." No, but by
Like,
saab
really,
they mean
like.
like this really like you crossed a boundary. I was just like, "Oh, it was open, like I didn't pay attention."
Like, it's tough for us to deal with.
Yeah, like, it's, yeah. I can't imagine doing that. So, yeah, it's, like, but I feel like there's kind of a playfulness in the language that has the potential to be exploited a lot, and the, like, rich sexual heritage of the in the language itself is what motivates me. Yeah, I guess the poetry in a sense is, like, very gender, you know, crosses all boundaries of gender for me. The poetry that I like, that is.
I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you so much for talking and being willing to go in so many different directions with me.
Sure.
I really appreciate it, and I'm glad that you're this conversation is part of this project.
Oh, yeah, you're most welcome. I have to listen to the others
now. Oh, yeah. Oh, please do. They're really good.
All right. Did you...